From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a very special edition of Truth and Justice. Over the last 6 weeks, we've moved on to Season 18, Justice Warriors, where we've had interviews every week with people that are doing good work in the criminal justice space, true warriors of justice to correct and help fix a broken system. This week, we're going to jump back to Season 17, our investigation into the wrongful conviction of Chris Bynum. In today's episode, we're not going to be breaking down case files, we're not going to be looking at crime scene photos, or doing any investigative work. Instead, what we're going to do today is we're going to hear from Chris Bynum himself, from inside the walls of prison. Before we get started, I want to just kind of prep you for what you're about to hear. Chris was excited to do the interview, he's excited to meet me, and he's excited to talk to all of you. That said, he's also been stuck in prison and has had his freedom taken away from him, and he's seen what can happen with media. He's seen what can happen with trusting other inmates or really anyone. So one thing that I noticed from this interview, and you're going to notice, is that Chris is very careful about what he says, thinks about his words before he shares them, and he's very reserved. He also knows, more than anyone else, that the actual murderer in this case is still out there. He knows he didn't do it, so he knows that someone did, and they could still be out in the free world. And for that reason, he's very cautious about talking about anyone that's on the outside because he fears for their safety. Joining me in the interview, who you don't hear through most of it, was Chris's attorney, as well as Dr. Nikki Jackson. And you will hear from Dr. Jackson at the end of the interview, because as we wrap things up, she had a few things that she wanted to share. And as you guys know, she knows Chris very well and has known him for years and has been working tirelessly on his case. So without any further ado, this is my interview with Chris Bynum himself. All right, Chris, first of all, I want to say it's a pleasure to meet you. I've got to speak with you for a couple of minutes here before we started recording, and it's been an interesting case for me. I've spent the last year working on your case and digging into every single nook and cranny of the case file and the transcripts, and it's abundantly clear to me that you're an innocent man that's been wrongfully convicted and wrongfully incarcerated for the last 26 years. It's not often that I go through that entire process before I meet the person that we're working with. So it's a real pleasure to meet you. And first and foremost, thanks for being willing to talk to me and talk to my audience so we can have this opportunity to get to know the person that everybody's working to help right now.
Thank you, Bob. And I appreciate you for looking into it.
It is my pleasure. And with that, we're going to walk through. I've just got a few questions for you. And this is, as I said, this is really about myself and my audience just getting to know you and also to better understand this experience. It's not often we get a chance to really hear from someone who's gone through the hell that you've gone through, being falsely accused and then arrested and then convicted and incarcerated. So the first thing that I'd like to do, Chris, in whatever capacity you're comfortable talking about it, I know because you were wrongfully accused and convicted that I feel very strongly that the real killer is still out there, and obviously you do too. So I know as we move through some of this stuff, there's going to be some things, people that you don't want to talk about for concerns for safety, so everybody understands that. But in whatever capacity you're comfortable talking about it, I'd like for you to tell me about your life, your family, what life was like for you before you got arrested and this hell started for you.
Okay, so growing up, obviously, it was in Gary, Indiana. I had four sisters and a younger brother that we all grew up in that house together with. So I was pretty protective. I had a bad relationship with my father because of abuse with my mom. So that made me really protective over her. By the time I was, 14, 15, I was already working. And I ran into a few hiccups. You know, I had a few bumps along the way growing up out there. And eventually, I straightened it out. I ended up being engaged to, of course, Shanita. Everybody's heard about her. Mm-hmm. I ended up with a job where I was out in the steel mill working for an outside contractor. You know, I thought I was doing pretty well for myself. You know, I took care of the things that I felt like were necessary. I felt like I was becoming a man. And outside of that, my life was pretty simple. It was basic.
Did you have goals for yourself? Before this all happened, had you thought about where you wanted to be maybe 5 years from then? Were you working towards anything?
Yes, I actually had an apprenticeship to be a brick mason. And the plan was to go to Georgia after Shanita, once she finished college. And yeah, just never got there because of this situation.
Regarding that situation, now I know you need to avoid discussing specifics about your case because of any potential appeals. But what I'd like to do is open this time up to you to talk about the experience of what you personally went through and what it was like for you being arrested and convicted for a crime you didn't commit. Most people, you know, we read about it, we hear about it, we listen to stories about it, but people just can't really understand, myself included, or have a real perception of what that's like, what it does to a person. So in whatever detail you're comfortable sharing, I'd like for you to talk about what these last 26 years have been like for you from being arrested, convicted, and your time spent in prison.
So it's been a lot. It's scary for one. One, the magnitude of this case. You know, growing up, if you get accused of something that you didn't do, that's hard enough. But when somebody accuses you of hurting somebody, especially in this case, there were four women that were hurt. I've never in my life hurt a man, let alone a woman. Mm-hmm. And to be as protective as I am over women, like I said, you know, having a lot of sisters and then to be accused of it, it was hurtful for me. You know, people have always, I'll say, they commended me for being who I was with my family and other women in the neighborhood, mm-hmm. you know, children. So it's always been like a nightmare to me. It's hurtful, you know, and to know that people even believed, I went a long time not understanding that people really believed it. I thought people knew that I was innocent.
When they first came for you and arrested you, during that time, obviously you're feeling that anger, confusion. You don't believe that people believe it. When did that finally set in for you that you may actually go to prison for this? Was there a time when you thought this is going to get cleared up?
Of course, I did. I've always, from the very beginning, I thought that it would be cleared up. I didn't understand again why I was even being accused, but when it became evident to me that people might think that I did, it was probably when we were about to go to trial. And I walked into the courtroom being me, you know, and I'm looking at people thinking like, you know, this is how the court system in America works. Maybe this is something I have to go through. I've even thought that it was a spiritual thing for a long time. Like, well, maybe it's somebody I'm supposed to meet and encourage. It wasn't until I saw people staring at me and the hate in their faces. Like, man, people think I did this. That's when it started setting in.
So I don't even really know how to phrase the question other than just, you know, I hate the, well, how did that make you feel type of question, but there has to be some kind of reaction because you go from that moment where you're arrested, you're being detained, you're going through the trial, there's still hope that you're going to get out of this, and then the conviction happens, and then from there, it's pretty quick. You move from there, and eventually you're moved all the way back to the jail and to prison, and now you're starting this new life in prison. What was life like for you in that first, let's say, month after you were convicted, and then you were moved in, housed in a prison where potentially you're going to spend the rest of your life?
The best way that I could describe that is being numb, angry, hurt, and then I cared so much about the feelings of my family because I watched how it affected them. I watched my mom, and it tore her down. You know, again, I don't know whether I'm a strong person or not, but my faith is strong. So I kept praying to God, and I'm thinking, I never thought I would have sat here all this time. The truth is, I still thought that maybe in the next couple months, they'll clear this up. You know, there's no way in this world they really think I did this. It was always a faith thing, and yeah.
Now, I say this with the caveat that I know, you know, the bar starts at bad, but Can you talk about your life in prison? Because that's one thing that surprised me over these last, you know, decade or so. I've been working with people that have been wrongfully convicted and have been in prison. Is at some point you have to accept that this is your life and you have to build a life in prison. Have you been able to do that while you're in there? What has life been like for you over these decades?
Well, I will say this. A lot of people have asked me how I adapted to this. I've never adapted, ever. To this very day, I can't say that I've ever become comfortable in here. I get up every single day praying and fighting. I'll never accept this. And to that, I'll also say that the anger that I had, it put me in a mindset where once I realized it wasn't going in the direction that I would, I didn't really care.
I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads. Have you developed any kind of, or do you have any kind of support network in there? Have you made friends, clergy, any groups that you're a part of in there, anything along the way to give yourself a support system while you've been inside?
Not in here. I don't believe in friends in here.
So you've just been, you've just really been on your own for this whole time.
Absolutely.
So in that regard, there's been people in and out of your life through your whole life. You had people that were connected to you before you were convicted, people that stuck with you through the years, and the new people that have come into your life since then. Let's kind of go through those in that order. Do you have people that have always stood by you from that knew you before this happened and that have stuck with you in one way or another throughout all these years?
Yeah, maybe one person, one of my siblings and my mom would have, but she passed away. But everybody else, I think so for some people, this is too much and it was hard, you know. Sometimes people will speak and, you know, they'll act like they want to come around. And before you know it, you know, they're missing again. And I don't hold it against them. I just, you know, they'll send their prayers, let me know that they're thinking about me. And yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I've heard from so many people that have been in for a long time is, you know, after a while, the mailbox is empty. Phone calls stop coming in. Visitors stop coming in. And it's not because people give up on you. It's just it's too easy to forget about that person when they're removed like you were or like you have been. If you mentioned your mom, have you lost people along the way? I mean, it's been 26 years.
Yes, lots of people, but my mom was probably the closest. And she passed away back in 2007. She was 49 years old. I've told people many times, I feel like this was just too much. She fought tooth and nail all the time, you know, trying to help me to prove my innocence. And I feel like it killed her.
Were you, I assume you weren't able to attend a funeral or anything like that for your mom?
No.
What was that like for you? Being that's the first big major thing that, or maybe there was other big major things, but that's a pretty big one that you now know you have to miss that you're not able to be a part of.
That was really hard for me. I want to say going back to being angry and hurt, that was the first time that I ever cried in prison, and probably the only time.
Yeah, and from what I've always been told, that's not something you want to do in prison.
It's absolutely not.
On a more positive note, I know that over these years, because I've met some of them, there are new people that have come into your life to help you with this fight. Talk about that. Who, anybody, and again, I know there's people you're not comfortable sharing exactly who they are, any details. Some maybe you are, because, you know, you've got support network type family type people and friends, and then you have people that have come in to help with the legal side of it. But so talk about, to however you're comfortable, people that have come into your life to help you as time has gone on and what that means to you.
So that goes back to my faith. I've never, ever lost faith. And to me, I just feel like that's when, you know, is God's way of answering my prayers. I'm always thankful. And those are the days that make me feel good and keep me going.
Do you feel like you have more of a support network from people from the outside now than you have before? Or has that been ebbs and flows over the years?
Absolutely. Now I do. I think it's more of the people who come to help me with my case, to be honest.
So you've mentioned your faith quite a bit. And yes. This has been a long process, multiple appeals. And I'm sure you've gotten your hope up and had the rug yanked out multiple times. You still have a whole team of attorneys and advocates that are working hard on your case still to this day, hoping to get you out of there. How do you feel about where your case stands today and the possibility of you finally being freed from your false imprisonment?
From a legal standpoint, I can't say, of course, but my faith is always, I know and I understand that things can change at any moment. You know, something could happen tomorrow. That's just the way that I feel about it. You know, as long as I have breath in my lungs, I'm not going to stop feeling that way, because I know that I'm innocent. I know I haven't done anything wrong, and perhaps there was a reason I had to go through this. But I know that my faith won't change, and that one day those doors are going to open.
Is it hard to hope?
I'm not going to say that it's hard to hope, because I don't have any choice.
Do you feel like by maintaining that hope and always maintaining that hope and faith, I was going to say, do you think it makes it harder for you to kind of heal and accept? But I don't know, from as I'm getting to know you a little bit, I don't know that you want to accept your position in your life where you're at.
I would never accept this position. I know I get up every day and I function, and there's no healing until this is over with. I get up and my intention is to make sure God knows that I still believe in Him and to stay strong for my family, because I know there are some of them who still believe in me. And of course, now my legal team, I never want to let them down.
Yeah, it's incredible, really. I don't think, you see me kind of stammering through this a little bit. I have expectations of how I think these answers are going to go sometimes, because I've done this a lot with a lot of people. And I feel like you're maybe the first person that I've met that, now there's, I can think of one other man named Jamie Snow out of he's in Illinois, not too far from you, who has refused to ever accept where he's at. But, you know, most of the time there comes a time where the people wrongfully convicted say that I have to accept this as my life, and they start moving on from it. And it's both heartbreaking and heartwarming for me at the same time that you've just 26 years in and you just won't accept it. You will not accept that life, that you're just going to keep fighting and hoping. So with that hope in mind, the mindset you've maintained throughout this and throughout this entire ordeal, if you're not putting your focus into making a life for yourself inside, have you spent time thinking about what your life is going to be like on the outside when you get out?
Yes. And over the years, you know, of course, things have changed. Years ago, I wanted to get out and become an attorney. That was my thing. I wanted to get out and help people so that they, you know, I guess less people would go through this. And now, if they were to let me out soon or whenever, I'd probably want to be a private investigator and help attorneys, you know, who cover cases like this and deal with them. But other than that and spending time with my children, you know, I haven't been able to spend any time with them.
Have you done anything inside to kind of work towards some of those goals? Like, have you done any schooling or anything while you've been inside?
Yes. Years ago, I obtained my associate's degree and then I ended up taking college out. So I wasn't able to finish my bachelor's, but I figured, you know, I'll be able to do that out there, take care of any schooling that I need to reach my goals.
Have you thought about if you were to get released today, what's the first thing that you'd want to eat when you get out?
I get asked that a lot. And to be honest with you, it probably wouldn't matter just because I've been in here so long. You know, I think freedom, I'd probably be too overwhelmed to even think about eating.
Yeah, it's a different, quite literally a different world. Yeah, I have a very close friend, dear friend of mine now that we helped get out of prison after 20 years. He went in 1999 and got out in 2018. And I spent that first week with him when he was out. And it was just, it's amazing the things that, you know, we take for granted that is someone that's been in that long, everything from a cell phone to the, his name is Ed Eight. He's in Texas. And I remember I took him to Walmart and he was mesmerized by they have self checkouts now where you check yourself out instead of somebody else ringing. And he was kind of the same way. We eventually sat down and had a real nice meal, but it was just overwhelmed by everything.
I could see that.
Do you have any nervousness about what that process would be? I mean, we have, you know, what you want to do, and obviously you want to spend time with your family and enjoy your freedom. But is there any apprehension or nervousness about how difficult that transition would be for you when you come out after all these years?
No, I think because I had already become acclimated to working and taking care of family, I don't think that would be an issue. There's a lot of anxiety just because I've been in here 26 years, but only lived out there 21 years. So that would be a completely different world for me. But I'd be more excited about it than anything.
I say I can imagine, but it's hard to imagine. And that's most people can't kind of admit that to themselves, that for someone who's never been through it, you can't imagine it. I have an idea of it. Well, I mean, I have a lot of faith and trust in your legal team and the advocates and the people that are all helping you. I took your case a year ago thinking this looks like this may not be a legitimate conviction. And we put a microscope on every element of it over this whole year. And it is abundantly 1,000% clear to me that you're innocent now. And so I wanted to just take these few minutes to meet you, get to know you a little bit, and just to be able to personally wish you the best. And I'm praying for you too. And this chokes me up more than it probably does you. You've been through it more, but man, I'm just really hoping and praying that we get you out of there soon.
Thank you. I really appreciate you.
And I'm going to, unless Chris, you have anything else you want to talk about, or Sam or Nick or anybody has anything that you want me to mention,
I think for me, what I'd love for everybody to know is that when Chris does get to come home, there are people waiting. We are waiting. He will have a really good support system. Timmy, who has been in his shoes, understands the challenges. And so one of the things that we try to do is to connect those who've been exonerated with other exonerees, not really the lawyers, but the exonerees who have lived this. And they best understand what Chris is going through, what his family's gone through. And we just celebrated Timmy's 10-year freedomversary. And I brought his family together, and listening to his mother, it's very hard. It's very, very hard. Like you, Bob, I get very emotional. And thankfully, Timmy's mother is still here. I wish Chris's mother was still here. But what I said to Timmy's mother would be the same thing, Chris, I would say to your mother, is that you will not walk out alone. You will have a group of people surrounding you and making sure that you have the things that you need to re-enter successfully.
Thank you.
Of course.
Chris, did you have anything else you want to add, or are you comfortable with what we got?
I just want to say thanks again to you, to my legal team, of course. And for your listeners, I just, you know, anybody who believes in me and people who've been in this situation, I'm thankful to them, because most people don't believe that once somebody's in here, that there's a possibility that they're innocent. That's not true. I just want people to understand that these things happen. And at least, you know, listen to the evidence, pay attention to what's going on. And I'm thankful to you.
Well, it's I speak on behalf of my entire audience that it's our pleasure. You know, Sam and Nikki and your whole team knows that anything you need, we're here for you guys to provide as much as we can. So with that being said, Chris, I'm going to let you go, and I'll let you carry on a conversation with your team here. But again, thanks to you, and thanks for everybody for getting this set up for me. And with that, I'm going to step out. But it's been great to meet you, Chris.
Thank you so much for taking the case. I haven't really had an opportunity to talk to you about that, but I know when I came to you, you know, you didn't grab it. And so I'm glad that your assistant brought it to you. And I hope that your listeners will really take heed in what Chris just said, that there are innocent people sitting in prison, factually innocent people. And we need a lot of support in bringing these folks home. I say it all the time. It's easy to lock up an innocent person, but it is so hard to bring them home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Chris, I don't know if you're aware of this, or if Nikki shared this with you, but the reason we got involved in the case is because of the hard work, besides Nikki, obviously, and all the work that she'd done and all your team that had passed it on to me. But it was from the hard work of an 18-year-old young woman, my producer, that is the one that dug deeply into your case and presented to me and said, this is the one.
Well, please tell her thank you.
She edits this, so she's going to hear it. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. Chris, great to meet you. Praying for you, buddy.
Thanks so much, Bob.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.